Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. Thank you so much for all of your feedback. Thank you, anybody who sent in a rating. That's really great. And for all those people who've just stopped me when I've seen them and said how much they have enjoyed the episodes that we've been doing together. So this time we're headed somewhere slightly different. We're going to the Road Haulage Association, and my guest today is Richard Smith, who is the Managing Director of the RHA. So Richard and I come across each other from time to time, but we'd never had quite the chance to have this conversation. And I started off by asking him, what's happening at the RHA?
Quite a lot of things, actually, Liam. Thanks for asking. And, you know, every day is a challenge. You know, every day there's a new perspective. If you look at the economy around us, but certainly more the way we engage with government. But while all those things changes, there still remains two to three core issues that was here 80 years ago when the RHA was formed, which is around the driver, the availability of the infrastructure that the vehicles move around, and also, you know, the price and the cost associated with it, because typically the road freight industry has always been low margins. You know, I mean, I've operated across Europe in various businesses, and I've enjoyed margins of 25%. You know, typically in the UK, it's less than 3%. So you can imagine the focus on, you know, if you fail one load in one day, you know, that is, some cases, profit wiped out for the week. So it's very low margin. And the state of the infrastructure adds to congestion. We did a piece of work last year, specifically on road haulage. It was a detailed survey, and we estimate there's £30 billion worth of cost driven in due to congestion last year. And that manifests itself in two ways. There's a cost to the actual haulier. So, you know, for every hour that you're stuck in traffic is an opportunity cost of doing something else. But there's a cost to the end user, whether it be a manufacturer or, particularly as the world's moving, you know, with the great advent of AI and technology tomorrow, of a just-in-time process from start to finish. Yeah, it's the same issues, but there's a different environment in which we are challenged, is how I like to describe it.
Yeah. We're all on both sides of this, aren't we? We want better margins and we want better contracts. But on the other hand, we're all guilty of ordering a DVD for $5.99 online. And there's not much in that $5.99, is there, for the transportation that gets to me delivered at home by tomorrow morning?
You're absolutely right. And, you know, over 35 years I've been in this industry now. And, you know, it's always been the last 5% as distribution cost. It's always referred to as the last 5% in the supply chain. And, you know, and I've worked on some big 3PL contracts all the way down to small margin. And I think the point you made there is really relevant around, we're driving this change as the consumers. You know, we want that instant access. And yep. I come from a generation where shops used to shut for half a day during the week.
I remember.
Morning, you know. And you had to queue for things, you know, particularly before Christmas, there'd be a queue from the butchers all the way down the street waiting for your turkey that you'd pre-ordered and paid for in the Christmas club. I just come from Yorkshire town. I'm very proud to do so as well. And then go over, you know, as technology's improved and has been a great enabler, our expectation has changed and driven it. But the one thing that's not changed is everyone's expectation is we'll take the cost out of the supply chain. You know, and we'll keep maintaining the margin elsewhere. And if you look at any economy, I would suggest it's very similar in America, it's very similar in Europe. So we do a lot of work with the IRU, going back to your RHA question. So the IRU being the global equivalent of the RHA. And, you know, they're the same issues. We expect everything delivered within 24 hours, which is great. But unfortunately, it's that supply chain that's getting squeezed in the middle.
Indeed. Well, look, don't worry. My dad was from Hull, so you're in good company from Yorkshire.
East Yorkshire. Now, you see, I'm from West Yorkshire. Nothing wrong with East Yorkshire, before I upset everybody. So I ran the Grimsby 10K at the weekend, actually. Yeah. I think one of the things, and you know, you're probably some of you, it's that work-life balance, you know, that you have to have, and working in a logistics environment. You see, I work 6 days a week, and I always have worked 6 days a week, and I am comfortable working 6 days a week because I know the yin and the yang that gives me the ability to do that. And I always describe myself genuinely as being very, I use the word blessed and fortunate to do that, you know, because, you know, I've been given opportunities to do certain things in my career, which I've taken, and it always involves working because that's what I enjoy doing. I've also got a family, you know, I've got two grown up, I've got a son and a daughter, and I've got a wife, so it works me. But every now and then I meet up with my brother, who's a lecturer at Sandhurst. It's interesting, you know, when you meet people, don't you find, you know, there's this sort of diverse background. So,
yeah.
My brother's the brains of the organisation, you know, and I'm the grafter, as I would describe it. You know, what I lack in ability, I make up for in desire. He's on my CV. But I did the Grimsby 10K, and I've got to tell you this story. And the reason, so I live in Wellingborough, and it was started at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. So the reason I did the Grimsby 10K is there was three reasons. One is I only see my brother four times a year, and it's when we go for a run, and I let him pick. But he's an academic, so he's not logistically savvy. He lives in Camberley, so it's even worse for him. And he ran the Grimsby 10K. It was one of the first 10Ks after lockdown that people could run. So our kid went in for it that year. I didn't, because I was doing something else. And ever since then, he's run it every year. So he's picked Grimsby. So I was up at 4 o'clock to drive up to Grimsby in my electric car. I mean, we must talk about electrification. It's a very interesting subject. So I had to make a stop before I got there so I could get back, which put an hour into the journey. Ran around Grimsby and then got my car and drove back up. But the point is, what lovely people in reference, such lovely, lovely people, you know, that I think one thing is when you go to places, and I've been lucky in my career to travel the world, and I know you've traveled extensively and run cross-border businesses and everything else as well, Liam. It's meeting those people and getting into that community and that culture thing. You know,
well, look, you're selling to the converted there. Firstly, my parents instilled in me that work was what you did for most of your life. It's what you did between leaving school and the last thing, whatever the last thing you did is. And I'm just with you on that. I hear a lot of people talk about 4-day weeks, 3-day weeks, all this sort of stuff. But actually, I think, and this is a terrible generalization, and there's plenty of cases against it, but actually, the people who are working a lot and are working hard stay fit and stay well. And they have the energy and they have the drive and so on. And the opposite side of that is, if you're not careful, if you lose your sense of purpose, then health stuff starts to come on top of you mentally and physically. And I hear, you know, many of my contemporaries saying, oh, you know, I just want to retire to the farm and, you know, look out the window and walk with the dog. Well, that's all right for a couple, that's all right for a week. But then what do you do that next week? And what do you do that wet Tuesday in February when the rain is belting against the side of your windows? Whereas, you know, in our case, you and me, I'm talking about here, we've got lots to do, haven't we? And still lots to do, and places to go, and people to see, and things to find out, and new technology, and all this exciting stuff. And I was with somebody yesterday, young chap, 27, in the rail industry, really excited about his career prospects in the rail industry. And I'm energized by that. If young people want to talk to me about how they might get on and do things, well, I'm excited about that. So I am certainly not sitting on some farm looking out the window, because that sounds like, that sounds pretty terrible to me. And frankly, with all this technology, I'm excited by it.
I agree. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, I got the electric car. So I got an electric car a year ago, picking up on the technology. And, you know, there's obviously, everyone says, well, you got it for the tax reasons and everything else. Well, it's always nice to save a few pounds because, you know, obviously the Yorkshireman at heart, and, you know, it's there's Yorkshire money and there's everybody else's. And I got the car for three reasons. One is it is absolutely the right thing to do. You know, this is the right thing to do, and we want the planet to, you know, to get better, because it's clearly not well at the moment in certain places. Right. You know, I were in London this morning and I walked from St Pancras down about 5:30 this morning, and it was blowing a gale, and, you know, we're almost on summer. So there's clearly an imbalance there. I'm going back to the car, so it's the right thing to do. The second reason, you know, I say this tongue in cheek, it was somebody else's money, you know, because I'm very blessed, you know, by doing the job I do, that somebody wants to buy me a car to drive 60,000 miles a year in. That's fine. I'll drive it. It's a nice car. It's nice, very comfortable. And, you know, the side of that is that somebody else's money. It's an unproven technology, really. You know, it works, you know, and I'm very pleased with the car. And I've done 26,000 miles in it. Drove up to Scotland from London yesterday and back, you know, four stops, you know, 800 miles, really comfortable. Great. And they drive themselves over. You know, it's helping me get in the car.
I have one too. And I don't know anything like as many miles as you do. But I'll tell you one thing, when people say to me about range anxiety, well, I've never had range anxiety. And the reason is, I personally can't travel for 250 miles without a stop. So I'm going to stop. So it's going to stop. And the only difference is that when I stop, for all the reasons that we might think about, and have a cup of tea and a sandwich and a walkabout, it's plugged in.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stop anyway. I'm not going to do 400 miles nonstop. I can't.
You see, that's a great one of the learning. You see, I was slightly different to you, whereas I would have got in my previous diesel car that had a range of 600 miles. And I gone, right, there's 400 there. That's my target. Oh, off I go. And it's really a bad advert, and for everything I preach, I always try to practice, you shouldn't drive for that long without a break, but now I've got to do. So it's actually forcing good behaviour. And I found it really exciting. The third reason I got it was for the range anxiety to test the theory, having run big fleets of trucks, because I understand, the restrictions that I put. For my job, I can pull over at Starbucks, I can get up the iPad and can have a lovely conversation, something like yourself, and we can just catch up and have 10 minutes. Now, I can do that, while my car's charging and I'm having a cup of tea and I'm refocusing my mind. Yeah. Can't do it on a truck. So that was the real reason. See how
no.
I read across. And is a stat that I use quite often at the moment, because there's a big assumption I feel that the industry, the HGV industry, the coach one I think is a little bit to be decided, but certainly usually where a truck goes, a coach follows. And from a technical perspective, I think it's fair to say.
For a long time, our coaches and buses were made out of truck parts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think the big issue for the trucks is everyone assuming it's going to be electric and battery electric. And the simple answer is it's not, because there's not that read across. There's a read across from cars to vans, to a degree, apart from, have you not found when you're charging your car that when a van tries to charge it, it's too big and it takes more spaces and it's too long and it can't get it.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly. That's right. And you see, we're all right with bus because they come home at night.
Exactly.
And for some coach applications, they come home at night. But for a lot of coach and a real load of truck, they're not coming home for days. That's the trick. So where do you see net zero on big truck, Richard?
I think the answer is we've just produced a report, actually. I'm not trying, which I will actually send to you as a separate. And it's an industry representative survey for coaches, vans and buses. And we took 3 months to compile it. And we did quantitative as well as qualitative. And it's 35 questions. The answer basically is 20%, I'll start off with HGV, 20% of the HGV world is either engaged with, i.e. has currently got an electric vehicle in the fleet, or is thinking about getting one in the next 5 years. The other 80%, not entertaining it. That's where they sit today. So
yeah.
Positive, that a fifth, if you play numbers, are actually on the journey, but four-fifths are not.
And I see 75% of coach operators, similarly, no plans for zero emission in the fleet.
I think the challenge with coaches is they're not being given a target when the diesel's not going to be available, because there's still not that target from government about when to phase that in.
And I sort of get the feeling from this government that some of those targets we've got are going to slip a bit, aren't they? Both the ending of internal combustion engine and the date for zero emission, that's going to slip a bit, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's what the report said. You've read the report. Well done, man. Because ultimately, it's got to slip if it's not practical. There are 500,000 HGVs in this country. Definition is above 3.5 ton for an HGV in that case. Okay, so you've got 26s, you've got 28s, you've got everything, you've got your 44 tonners. How many are electric?
Go on.
Less than 600.
Wow. Okay.
In 2019, when this legislative framework was put in place by the then government, 2035 and 2040, to phase out 26 ton in 2035 and then the rest of 2040. So we've moved 500 vehicles since then. So going back to your point, you don't have to be Columbo to work out the fact that it's not going to be achieved.
We haven't got mature technology for truck yet, have we? I mean, I'd love the answer to be hydrogen. But I think it's fair to say, certainly on bus, there's not one atom of green hydrogen has ever been used to power a bus in this country. And I brought the first hydrogen buses into London, 2004.
Yeah.
20 years ago, they told me this is just around the corner. Well, guess what? 20 years later, it's still just around the corner.
Was that Boris Johnson's era as Metro Mayor? Sorry, not as the Mayor of London.
No, it's under Ken.
Was that under Ken? That's right.
Under Ken. Ken 2000 to 2008. So under Ken, we had three Mercedes hydrogen buses. In fact, there were trios of Mercedes buses, all hydrogen, across Europe, Perth, Western Australia, and Reykjavik. So there was London, Milan, Hamburg. And look, they ran very well, but they were £750,000 each. And they had to come back in the middle of the afternoon because that was run out of puff at that point. Now, things have moved on, but there's no hydrogen infrastructure in this country to fuel them with. The equipment is still pretty bulky. Yeah. And there's still 50 kilos of hydrogen at 350 bar in the roof. So I'd love hydrogen to be the answer. And, Joe Bamford, JCB, Joe Bamford, who's been a guest on here, he's a great evangelist for hydrogen. But we're not quite there yet, are we? Certainly not for truck.
I agree. I mean, I can see if you go back to Joe Bamford and the JCB, which is phenomenal work that those guys do. There's innovators. There's real entrepreneurs, you know, should be commended. I can see it working in that area. You know, it's if you're, you know, particularly, I think one of the challenges, going back to your point from the HGV, it's such a broad church of sectors that it covers across. Because, you know, we always describe it, another stat, 80% of what's in your room will have come on a big truck at some point in its life. And when you think about it, there's 32 sectors that make up the HGV sector. You've got chill, you've got frozen, you've got tankers, blah, 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 blah. I know, you know. Yeah. And you think about those solutions. So in the middle of a quarry, you've not got a big power cable. You know, it's going to be something that has to be almost like a standalone fuel or something you can bunker. So our position, just going down, is really that it'll be a number of fuels that are the solution. You know, so we're not ruling out hydrogen because it'll have a role to play. But one of the big things at the moment is the intermediate fuels is quite interesting. And by that, I mean the HVO, you know, and the gas, you know, is available. Is, you know, we need some clarity and prioritisation, I think, from the government on who's going to get the HVO. Limited in supply, 95% impact. Is it going to be ferries? Probably. Is it going to be planes? Probably. And then we know as an industry that it's not going to be, because it's limited in supply, it's not going to be us, and we should start to probably look more seriously, because hydrogen does work in other countries, as they say, you know, and it's that desire in that direction. So it's one of the reasons why people are leaving the industry at this moment in time is this uncertainty around the future of the fuel.
Indeed. And if you're a smaller operator, and we've seen on Bus and Coach the demise of all the family type businesses, is the sort of money you've got to put up for some of this stuff is huge. And the risk is huge, isn't it? You know, I mean, if you're running a small business, especially a low margin small business, you've only got to make a big mistake in your technology and you're out of the game altogether. So people are choosing to leave the game rather than live with the uncertainty, aren't they?
Correct. I mean, you know, a truck, you want to buy one of the big boys, you know, 120 grand now, typically, diesel truck. You want to buy an electric equivalent, 300. And again, so it's already crossing relevant. It's, you know, it's that, are you going to be, going back to my point about my car, are you going to invest your hard earned, you know, in something that's an unproven technology? And one of our concerns as well, we don't want the solution forced upon us because we are an island. And, you will relate to this. We're not Europe, you know. I've run European haulage businesses, and it is very different. You know, and we can go coast to coast quite easily, you know, within a day, within a shift.
Yeah.
You know? So therefore, the fuels and the type of adoption is slightly different. And the truck manufacturers are all, with the exception of DAF, European based. So what works in Germany, what works in America, what might work in India, might not work in the UK.
No, no, for sure. Going back to the point we made earlier. All right, so I order something on Amazon for $5.99. If there was an option to pay $6.99 and for it to be delivered by an electric truck, would I press that button? The consumer is not yet ready to pay a higher fee to put their part in saving the planet, because people are inherently selfish and they'll buy the cheapest that they can, commensurate with quality and all the rest of it, but they'll go for the best deal. And there's no feeling, I don't think, in the out there in the marketplace that people want to pay higher prices in order for sustainable transport to deliver it, and they're certainly not willing to pay a higher bus fare to travel on an electric or a hydrogen bus, and they're not willing to pay a higher coach ticket price either. So they're certainly not going to do it in the supply chain.
No, I agree. I mean, there's always, certainly in this industry, is what I call the race to the bottom. You know, I'll do it for £5 less.
I'll tell you the other thing that bothers me a bit. You know, I chair the Highways Sector Council. And so at the point of this recording, we're waiting on the spending review. By the time we broadcast, we should have received it. And the campaign we always make, and I know you make it as well, is if we had a consistent roads investment policy, so that roughly every year we knew we were going to get about X, which means that the highway infrastructure thing could be planned, apprenticeships, investment in plant and equipment, investment in people, because you knew in terms of road building and road maintenance, every year there'd be about this much of it. Because we don't get that, do we? We're on off, on off, on off. Goodness knows, you know. And the highway infrastructure budget is the one that's been sliced every year. We'll just take another slice out of the highways budget because it's so big. And I know you've been campaigning because the condition of the highway in its widest sense, which includes the pavement as well as the road and all the rest of it, is grim. If I want to be really funny about it, the combination of all this rainfall and burst water mains from poor Victorian infrastructure, is washing away the subsoil underneath the highways, which is why we have all the potholes and all the rest of it. Without Russian oil, the quality of the tarmac's not as good, so we've got inferior blacktop on top of big holes, and that's not a good place to be if you're in the truck business, is it?
You know, it's amazing. It's always, I always like talking to wise people because it's amazing what you learn. It just comes together like a, you know, it does, doesn't it? That bit about the Russian oil is just that's, I like to learn. One of the things we spoke earlier on about why you get out of bed in the morning, we didn't quite say that, but the inference was that. And it's for that sort of reason, isn't it? You got to learn something every day, and there's always something. But no, I totally agree. I mean, one of the couple of the stats that I always think about when it comes to, I mean, you know, the workplace is the road, you know, for our industry. That's what it is. That's where you do your job. I mean, we're sat in a desk and then talking away and doing everything else that we're doing. But actually, that workplace is a truck. You know, one in four bridges in the UK cannot carry more than 40 tons. Fact. It's one in four. So when you've got a 44-ton vehicle, or when you've got the abnormal load stuff, which, you know, the big ugly stuff that you get stuck behind and get very frustrated. The road, which is becoming more and more because everything is becoming modular, going back to the point about technology. So the 1.5 million houses, majority of those houses, yes, will be modular, so there'll be more of that moving somewhere. On roads that are not, you know, capable of supporting what we've got now, over bridges that can't carry 44 ton, never mind 80. You know, it does raise serious questions about prioritisation of spend. And the stat that always resonates with me, Leon, is it the strategic road network is 2% of the roads in this country. And it carries over 65% of the freight. If you're looking at the theory of constraints, you know, and I did an MBA a few years ago, just so I did the MBA, was to, I'd worked in industry for 25 years. And I wanted to see if the academic theory was actually my learning and experience. And the answer to the question was from the area I looked at, which was around change management, was yes. You know, there was a, I could relate and resonate to it quite strongly. But one of the key things, that, you know, that I also took away from the MBA as well is you've got to have a smooth process to be efficient. And, you know, the roads are creating a massive amount of inefficiency in this country across all sectors. But because this industry, and it's the same in buses as it is in coaches, in trucks, we always make it happen. We're very resilient. Until it doesn't happen, people don't see the issue.
And we could argue, couldn't we, that if COVID had come 10 years earlier, we wouldn't have had the Wi-Fi broadband capacity to do all this work from home, Lark. And secondly, we wouldn't have had the last mile delivery capability to bring us our food, our drinks, whatever it was we needed. But we were dead lucky. 10 years sooner, 2010, we wouldn't have been in anything like the position that we were in. So we were dead lucky with COVID. And as time goes on, we're increasingly reliant on the road network to deliver us everything that we want and so on by yesterday.
I think that's another challenge that we have in society, not something about particularly in this industry where I always say you got to walk a mile in somebody's shoes, you know, it's a Yorkshire thing. Actually understand the detail, or at least, you know, one of the things in, if you're in your career, what's one of the, I'm asking myself questions, what's one of your biggest learnings? And I think it's an ability, this, and it's something I've learned, and I'm quite good at now, the ability to listen and truly listen, not sit there and be quiet, there's a difference. You know, to listen and absorb and to then reflect and think about it. And, you know, with all the advent of technology, just going back to the technology theme, which, you know, ChatGPT, it always starts me off with a good speech. You know, I don't use it at all because I don't use words like wow and, you know, but, you know, it starts me off. It gives you a good basis. You've got all this technology around you. You know, I think people assume a lot more because it's easier to Google what those nice words that you just said about the Russian tarmac were rather than actually go and speak to somebody about it. And don't you think that that in life is becoming a bit of a worrying trait because we're becoming a lot less personable?
Well, completely so, completely so. And I'm afraid I did say something wicked the other day. There was somebody was talking about the government, greater use of AI in government, and I said, "Well, I'd settle for the I."
No, that's, no, I like
Yeah,
that.
you can use that. I didn't get that from ChatGPT, but I think entirely right. If we're not careful, the conversations will be taking place between bits of artificial intelligence.
Correct.
And we'll just be spectating on the outside, and it'll narrow our interest, because the great thing about humans is humans are curious, so they're interested in loads and loads and loads of things. And I'm going to come away from this conversation curious about some stuff. You are as well, and hopefully all the listeners will, and they'll go away and be curious. The trouble with AI in its rawest form is that it stops you being curious because it gives you an instant answer, which you then accept. And you say, well, that must be right then. So for me, that's a worry. And the same way, I am not the world's greatest fan of working from home, because for me, it is the chance conversations by the coffee machine or the people you meet in the lift or the walking past somebody's desk and say, hey, I'm glad I've seen you. What about this? That's where we're creative. That's where we invent things. That sort of, and working from home doesn't do that.
No, I totally agree. And I think one of the things, I mean, I'll just, we did this, we've just done a net zero sale that I referred to.
Yeah.
I've 500 hard copies that I have had printed off. And the reason I'm sat in Westminster at the minute, I'm going to round to the departments this afternoon. And just like Father Christmas, I'm going to go and give these out. I've sent soft copies, but I'm actually going to give them to them because I do believe, you know, that if there's, you know, this industry is somebody wants to describe to me, it's mouse mats, pens and caps. You know, if you ever do an event, mouse mats, because they'll take them. You know, because people, and then if it's on your desk, yep, you've got a phone number on it and something's going wrong, well, I'll ring that number because it's there and it's in front of you.
Well,
your point exactly, and it enables you, curious. I went to see my financial advisor a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't a long conversation, it never is. and she said to me, do you mind if we record the meeting? I said, not a problem. I said, I don't think it's not going to be that sort of meeting. She said, because it's this AI bot that they're developing. I said, do you know Sue? Because obviously that's the name. I said, there'll come a point where I'm just talking to a virtual screen and they'll give me all this financial advice. I mean, how would you feel about that? I mean, I don't know if I'd ever trust that, but that might be my
generation. No, in the case of my financial advisor, I look him in his eyes and say, is this what you really think? Do you really believe it? Because I set great store by the sincerity and the trustworthiness of the human in this.
Yeah.
If he says to me, I think this is the right thing to do, my inclination is to say, well, you're the expert and I'm not. And if you think it's the right thing to do, then I'll go with it. That's fine. You know, I'll ask, I'll challenge, I'll, what about this? What about that? But at the end of the day, I'm taking his personal professional recommendation. Talking on AI, the other week I was at an event where I recorded the speech, which was in French. So in the 60 seconds after it finished, not only did it give me the notes of the meeting, it translated those notes into English for me.
Phenomenal.
And they tell me the next generation of Apple iPods will allow you to converse in the street, listening to somebody speaking to you in a foreign language and your pods telling you that in English.
And you can see that, can't you? From what I know, you can really see that and think what... I mean, I worked in Italy for 3 years as part of my career, and I was typical Yorkshire man abroad. You know, and I mean that respectfully to from Yorkshire listeners. I was a person where I assumed that everybody would learn my language, which was very rude, which was very uneducated. And I think, you know, but it's such an enabler, is that technology fused right. You can see, and you can see how it's going to reconfigure the skills requirement, because skills is a massive issue across every sector.
Yep.
You know, in our, you know, it's about drivers, it's about mechanics. But actually recruiting in any area, because the RHA employs 123 people, you know, obviously, and it's, you know, we have a account team, we have HR team, we have all marketing teams, and so we're actively recruiting across a broad church of skills. And, you know, one of our challenges that I've set the team this year, and I'm actively really energized about, is how can we adopt AI, not to get rid of the 123 people, but actually to make their working environment easier so they can do more. So I'm always a bit, you know, and become more efficient and actually stay relevant and provide a faster service and provide a more robust process.
And probably a more interesting job.
Exactly.
I don't know about you. I'm actually quite optimistic about young people. They're a bit more environmentally sensitive than we are. They are driven by all this exciting stuff that's coming along. And I'm also in a sort of geopolitics of this. I hope it's the young people that will get us out of some of the skirmishes that we're in around the world, you know, Ukraine and Israel and so on, because I'd like to believe the young people coming through are not carrying the baggage of their predecessors. So I'd like to believe that the world will be a better place as a result of the young people. But in turn, that gives us a bit of a job to do to make sure these young people get the skills and the experience and the fulfillment that we've had in our lives. Because if they simply think that you can sit at home because the Chancellor can borrow an infinite amount of money and pay you 80% of your wages for no work, then we're in a very bad way. But I'd like to believe the young people are keen to be economically active and drive things forwards and be friendly to the planet and to each other. That's what I'd like to believe.
I agree. I mean, I, you know, I've I share that. I've got a 25-year-old son and a 21-year-old daughter, and they both sit in that space that you just described. I'm very proud of them. But I think also when you, I can see, and it's probably, there's five generations in the workplace, if you look at that. I went to a fascinating roundtable event recently, and it's about how you communicate with those generations as well, because I think a key part, you know, when you mentioned it earlier on, Liam, from your perspective, and I'm the same, there's nothing that pleases me more if I see somebody in any organisation I run either leave and go on to bigger and better things or take my job, you know, and it's of a different generation as in a young, well, he's a younger one now because of my generation. I think you've really achieved something as an employer, as a person by doing that. And I do think majority of people in younger generations that I meet have got that desire. And I think it's important that it's a different way we need to communicate going forward rather than it used to be, because you used to be told what to do. That was it. You know, you left school when I was leaving school. You either went down the pit because it was that thing. You joined police force, you joined the army, or if you were lucky, you might go to university if the government would fund that and get a law degree or an accounts degree and go into a profession. That was kind of your career path in life, or become a driver, actually. You know, cause that was, now, the world generally, you know, I wish I was 25 again in some ways with the knowledge I've got at my age, you know, because I'd be off, you know, and it'd be so exciting. But I think they lack a little bit of structure to actually see, quite a lot of them, to see the direction they need to travel in. They've got too many choices, if that makes sense.
No, sure. And it's interesting because one of the things we've done at Highway Sector Council is to start really talking to young people about highways as a career. And the level of ignorance is shocking, because you talk to young people about highways and they think you mean digging holes in the road. And they've no idea about the design, the planning, the structural engineering, the science, the civil engineering, everything that goes with it. Because as a young person, just as you say, they've got too much choice and they want to be influencers in social media and they want to be they want to do video games and stuff. My dad, who I referred to earlier, so here's another Yorkshire comment. He said, of course, he was saying this in the 1950s. He was saying, unless you dig it out the ground, make it into something and sell it overseas, you haven't really made any money. All you've done is move it around a bit. And I've never sort of lost sight of the fact that somebody somewhere, so that I can go to a restaurant in the evening or go to a wine bar in the evening or read a newspaper or get on the bus, somebody somewhere must have made enough money by making something and moving it on. Now, he was talking about that before financial services became the thing that it did, but broadly it holds true. And one of the things I think that's great in transport, at least, is that what you do is sort of very relevant. Like you can see it tomorrow, whether you're in engineering, whether you're in operations, in transport generally, the actual consequence of your actions are evident to you. And I think that's very satisfying. Whereas if you were, with apologies, a social media influencer, I'm not sure what the satisfaction of that is, because you may or may not have moved a dial and you'll never know. So for me, the satisfaction in transport is really important.
No, I agree. I mean, you get that, in, it's almost like an instant gratification, or you get not so much gratification, you get that feedback, and it's, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but you, I think knowing if you've had a good day is quite important to people. I mean, you know, every day when I, every morning when I get up, which is usually about 4:30 and I go for a run, but that's how my body clock works. I'll always look in the mirror and think, you know, did I add value yesterday?
Yeah,
no. I add value. And if not, what am I going to do today different? I think that, I'm not just running around the house chanting it to everybody. I think it's that inner clock. And the other thing I learned a long time ago, Leon, and I think this is missing a little bit these days, and part of it is social media, but part of it is culture, is that, you know, I was taught when I was brought up, and I always do it now, is to say thank you to people. Kill them with kindness. Be nice to people, because it's a nice world. And I don't mean that in a, you know, like yourself, you know, I've had to make some big decisions in business because I come from a business background. I made some big, tough decisions where people have lost a job as a result of it. And that's not a nice situation. Or you've had to do X, Y, and Z, but there's a certain way you should always do it. And you should do it, what I call, a nice way, or as nice as you can.
No, no. And in fact, to the 27-year-old I was talking to yesterday, he asked me, he said, what's your one piece of advice in my career? And I said, In your professional career, you will, from time to time, be asked to pull a rabbit out of the hat. Do yourself a favor. Invest in a rabbit. Put something in the pot. Invest in people. Invest in time. Invest in knowledge. Invest in something. When somebody asks you to do something that's really important, the lever's got to be connected to something. This is not the time to pull on the lever and find that it's not connected. You need to be able to, and you're going to be pulling on personal relationships, friendships, somebody you've been out for a drink with, or something you've learnt about, or knowledge that you've learnt about. And so, that's what he went away with. So there's my advice to everybody listening. If you're a young person, invest in a rabbit.
The reason why I insist on being called the managing director is because my job as the managing director of the RHA is to deliver the plan of the shareholders are the members.
Okay.
That's what
Right.
an MD does. A CEO, with great respect, is a visionary, and there's nothing wrong with other CEOs sitting in the trade association place, but this industry right now doesn't need a visionary, it needs someone that delivers the plan of the shareholders.
So my guest on this podcast has been Richard Smith, who is the managing director of the Road Haulage Association. You can find out everything you need to know about the benefits there at rha.co.uk. Everything there about membership, latest news in the industry, training events, and all the things that the RHA delivers for its 8,500 members across the country, which covers bus and coach as well as truck and haulage. So that's all fascinating. This has been Lunch with Leon, produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. That's passengertransport.org.uk. I have really enjoyed my chat with Richard. We have just resolved that we're going to go and have another version of this that's going to be in private, but I'm sure Richard will come back for another chat here at Lunch with Leon at some point in the future. So that just leaves it for me to say to Richard Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lynn, and look forward to the catch up again.
You have been listening to Lunch with Leon. Your host was Leon Daniels, and his guest was Richard Smith, Managing Director of the Road Haulage Association. PR support was by Stark Communications. Please leave us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.